From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, it's Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. More than a week has passed since Election Day 2020. President-elect Joe Biden is moving forward with his transition plans. Key Republican leaders are quiet, and there are questions about whether the American public is as divided as it's ever been. In North Carolina, Republicans head into the next legislative session with an as yet unofficial 70-50 majority in the House and a 29-21 majority in the Senate. Voter turnout in North Carolina was, like much of the nation, historic. Almost 75% of registered voters cast a ballot. By comparison, in 2016, 69% turned out. And it's not a surprise which parts of the state lean toward Biden and which went for Trump. As the Charlotte Observer explains, mostly Cooper scored big margins in urban and predominantly black counties, while Trump dominated in rural and outer suburban counties. And while we know that North Carolina was a closely watched state during the election, it remains an anomaly. Why is it that North Carolinians appear to have favored Republican President Donald Trump and Democratic Governor Roy Cooper? And why is it that New Hanover and Brunswick counties, neighbors centered around the same mini metropolis of Wilmington, behave so differently? New Hanover County went blue near the top of the ballot, with some patchwork purple on the way down. Brunswick County stayed reliably red with eerily consistent margins all the way down the ballot. Today, we'll take a look at some of these results and what they tell us. Joining me now, Scott Nunn, freelance journalist based in Wilmington and former opinion editor of the Star News, where he worked for nearly three decades. He's also a regular contributor to the Greater Wilmington Business Journal. Scott Nunn, welcome to Coastline.
Hey, thank you. It's great to be here.
Great to have you here. And also with us today, WHQR's managing editor, Ben Schachman. Welcome, Ben.
Thank you, Rachel.
Now, let's talk nuts and bolts first. No one seems to doubt President Trump wins North Carolina, but where are we now in terms of the vote count? How many more days will officials be accepting ballots? And what's the process from here, Ben Schachman?
So I believe tomorrow is the last day to receive absentee ballots that were mailed in that were postmarked by Election Day, November 3rd. Tomorrow's also the day where counties, most counties, will begin actually going through ballots and start that long, arduous count for the canvas meeting on Friday. So Friday the 13th, what could go wrong? We'll be having all of our canvas counts. And that's when we're, at least at the county level, finally going to see sort of the sum total of provisional ballots that were accepted, absentee ballots, and of course, Election Day in-person voting. And then the following week, just for people who are watching these things, Monday is the deadline for local races for recount, so Monday at 5. So if we're going to hear about a local race, like a county commissioner or a school board race, we'll hear about that by Monday. And for state-level races, it's Tuesday at noon. So we could see, you know, press releases about that kind of thing all the way through Tuesday morning.
So what are some of the races, Scott Nunn, that we're watching that we could see changes in outcomes of? I mean, just starting with the presidential race, we're looking at a difference right now of 1.34 percentage points, which is about a little more than 73,000 votes. Is anyone expecting that to change?
Well, I think, like you said, it's clear that Trump is going to win North Carolina. I think even though there are plenty of votes out, that the people who are the experts on counting this know what votes are out there and how they're likely to fall. Although the pollsters haven't had a great record, the people who analyze what votes are still out have tended to do pretty well. Locally, I think the county commissioner's race in New Hanover County, there's still some interesting possibilities there with the incumbent Jonathan Barfield and a former member Skip Watkins, and then also the state senate race between Harper Peterson and once again a former state senator Michael Lee. And Michael Lee does appear to have retaken the seat, possibly if that fairly narrow lead holds up. And the best I recall, last year, the last time around, that race had a recount. So yeah, and I think that is an example of how New Hanover County is becoming a difficult place to put your finger on exactly how it's going to fall.
Yeah.
Versus Brunswick County, which is not many surprises there.
Yeah, now we heard so much about the role of the pandemic in voting this year and early voting. Ben Shachtman, how did, just for the record, early voting compare to Election Day?
Just traveling around the polling locations on November 3rd, it was almost eerily quiet. And the prevailing opinion was that so many people really had taken advantage of early either mail-in voting or early in-person voting. And the numbers, it varied county to county, but in some places we were seeing early voting numbers that had exceeded total voting in previous elections. So off the charts is not too much of a hyperbole.
Yeah. Now, I mentioned in the introduction that some people are arguing the American public is as divided as it's ever been. Others are saying, no, this actually represents an opportunity for a reset and for perhaps some bipartisan interest in collaboration and cooperation that we haven't really had before. But to kind of get a sense of this, and of course, this is not scientific as none of the polls were leading up to this election. No, I shouldn't say that. We're gonna talk about the polls in a minute, but I wanna hear from Daryl. This person was a member of our Beneath the Surface group. It was a civil discourse exercise from 2019. We had about a dozen people of different ages, races, and political affiliations. And we spoke with three of the folks from this group about the 2020 election outcome and how they felt. And Daryl, you should know, describes himself as a rational, compassionate conservative, lives in Brunswick County, very involved in the GOP there. And this is what he said.
The American voters have rejected hubris and would like to embrace humility. We as Americans like conservative governance, very conservative governance, but we want that governance to be rational and compassionate. And this election and the non-presidential side of things has proven that.
Ben Shachtman, I'm curious, does Daryl's position right now, he was willing to talk with us. He talked a lot about rationality with me and compassionate conservative governance. Does that sound to you like what you're hearing around the region from other folks either involved in the GOP or who tend to vote that way?
So I think we're still waiting on some people to speak their piece when the election is, I think, when all the legal challenges are done. But to a certain extent, yeah, I think. But at the same time, I think there are pretty vocal parties on the left and the right who are absolutely opposed to this idea of compromise and unity, and that we should accept some kind of centrist unity government, right? But if you look at the votes, right, the plurality voice of unaffiliated, I think that might be what Daryl is speaking to as well. In addition to conservatives who would prefer maybe, fiscal conservatism with maybe a kindler, gentler face. But I think he's also, to a certain extent, talking about unaffiliated voters who see, that's what this race was all about. So I think, to a certain extent, yeah, it's about those unaffiliated voters who may not be liberal progressives by any stretch of the imagination, but certainly chose a different path.
And I thought it was interesting he pulled out the ideas of humility and hubris and saw the election as a referendum on that. I think we have time to get to one more member of our group. Lydia was one of the younger members of the group and I think talked about herself as a progressive.
It was a really good outcome, mostly because I feel like it's a sign that the American public is operating in a rational manner. The fact that Donald Trump needed to be repudiated, he was repudiated.
And there we are again with the idea of rationality in the election by two people who might be at very different ends of the political spectrum, which, one of them is in New Hanover County and one is in Brunswick County. But Scott Nunn, this is, you mentioned this earlier, but this is sort of emblematic of New Hanover County's odd purpley personality. What are some of the elements of New Hanover County's behavior in this election that illustrate that to you?
Well, I mean, I think my guess is we're a little more diverse than Brunswick County. Brunswick is unique. It's the fastest growing county in the state, one of the fastest growing counties in the nation, but it's also the oldest county in the state. So I've not dug down that deep into the numbers, but I suspect that, especially the older white male has done well for Trump. And anecdotally, with people I've talked to, I mean, I think that makes sense. I think that New Hanover County's, the retirees in New Hanover County might be a little more, not only retirees, but newcomers, a little more diverse in age and their demographics. So I think that Brunswick is very unique, not only in our area, but across the state. I think it's a unique place.
Yeah, and you mentioned that Brunswick County is one of the fastest growing parts. Ben Shockman, how do we process the idea of the influx of retirees from the Northeast, which have often been considered leaning liberal?
I think we're coming up on a break, so I'm going to say real quick, the turnover is even greater than the total increase, because for every 100,000 you've got coming in, it's really 300,000 new people coming in and 200,000 leaving out. So it's a lot more complicated.
All right. You're listening to Coastline. It's a look at the 2020 election results, what we've learned so far, what we're waiting to see. And when we come back from this break, we'll have a look at some of the local races and the policy implications with Scott Nunn and Ben Shockman. Stay with us. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. And if you like some of this new Coastline music, give a shout out to technical director Ken Campbell. We're experimenting. Let us know what you think. Now, we're more than a week past the 2020 general election. It's a reporter roundtable today with former opinion editor of the Star News and freelance journalist Scott Nunn and HQR managing editor Ben Shockman. Before we move on, I want to get to the third person from our Beneath the Surface group. Again, this was a 2019 exercise in civil discourse. We brought together about a dozen people of different ages, races, political affiliations for a year to see if how their conversation changed over the course of the year and if they could learn to like each other in spite of their differences. And this next person we're going to hear from, Carl, launched a pretty important conversation then about race and politics. And he explained to us back then why, as a person who is African American, he didn't tend to lean left or right, because historically, no matter what the politician said once they were in office, neither major party ever really addressed Black issues. But this is what he told us about his views on this year's election outcome.
I think it gives our country an opportunity to go in a different direction and try new things, different things, try to go back to where we were. You know, when I saw the people come out that night and celebrate because President-elect Biden won, there were no guns, there were no violence. There's all the things that people said would happen, didn't happen. And our country is not that way, and it needs to be clearly portrayed in the true sense.
Scott Nunn, on the polling front, the public opinion front, there's been a lot of confusion about what pollsters told us. There's been criticism about what they told us. And, you know, as President George W. Bush once said, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me. You can't get fooled again. Did we get fooled again in 2020 with the polls, or did you?
I think we did a little bit, and the results are still out. It takes for the poll numbers to actually be analyzed completely, we do need these very final numbers. But I was doing some reading this morning some of the lookbacks. And for example, in 10 of the key, what were considered key states, and this is at the national level, Trump's support for Trump was underestimated on average by 4.5%, which was the same as it was in 2016. What I'm hearing from some of the analysis, or what I've read in some of the analysis, is the pollsters and the polling type experts say they missed it again, but they're saying perhaps for a different reason, and they're also still learning some lessons. I think the big thing is pollsters, we need to really take them with a good amount of skepticism, and also understood that for example, the Biden campaign, their internal polls, they said, were much closer than what they were seeing in the media. And they were making their decisions based on their internal polls. So why can Joe Biden's campaign get good polls, but the national media can't? And once again, they're not in these close races, they're always going to be tough. And these are some of the margins of error, or within these, within the numbers that came out. But yeah, it wasn't a great year for the pollsters again, that's for sure.
Ben Shachtman, do you think that we are going to be leaving the pollsters behind in terms of, as members of the news media are relying on what they tell us?
I mean, 4 years ago, tomorrow is the one-year anniversary of Princeton University neuroscience professor Sam Wang eating a cricket on CNN, which he promised to do if he miscalled the election. In 2016, he called the election for Hillary Clinton and was wrong. And there was, a backlash in 2016, people saying that the polling industry was over. This year, it was interesting. We had quite a few people share with us the Vegas odds, which tend to be, which in some cases were actually quite a bit more accurate than the polls. I don't think we're done with it. My hope is that the election cycle, which is at least at CNN explicitly based on ESPN, it's based on like tournament sports championships, that we can move a little bit away from that. Because if you dig deep down into it, what the polls are doing is, they're aware of where the holes are. There are certain demographics that they just can't get to because these people are not predisposed to answer polls or answer phone numbers that they don't recognize. And so they try to make up for that with AI, with basically, well-educated guesswork. And they might be able to dial that in, but I ultimately hope that, we can just sort of get to a place where we're talking about policy and leave a little bit of the guesswork out, because at the end of the day, we sort of, the pollsters are either right or they're wrong, but I don't think we were richer and wiser for having watched the polls going into the election.
And here's another interesting tidbit: is the 2016 pollsters are terrible. 2020, not much better. 2018, they hit it pretty well. So some of the reading I said is that Trump changes the dynamic of the election. I think that's perhaps a fair analysis. So why are they so good at predicting what happened in 2018? And obviously, those are not presidential races, but once you throw Trump into the picture, it changes things. It's because they also, they were probably even worse on the Senate races this year than they were on the, on the presidential race. Cal Cunningham obviously didn't win North Carolina. And he was expected at one time, to do fairly well here. So there's the Trump factor, I think, is legitimate.
But, that's an interesting race to bring up, Scott Nunn, because is it possible that Cal Cunningham lost because of his sexting scandal, or is it because the polls were wrong? I mean, for a while, didn't he have a double-digit lead in the polls over incumbent Republican Senator Tom Tillis? And then a couple of weeks after that news broke about his affair, that's when his numbers started to drop?
I suspect it's a combination, but just from the impression I get is that double digit or that such a fairly big lead was never there. That just does not seem to hold out in North Carolina for whatever reason. And I don't think there's anything. It's not a conspiracy. Pollsters want to be right. They're not out there trying to, that's the way they can make their name, is by being, who gets it right. And they're not doing it for any nefarious reason, but they're missing something. And I think they're aware of that, and they're desperately trying to figure out what it is. that they're missing. That's, you know, they're so they're continually getting this, you know, getting it wrong.
You're listening to Coastline. Today we're looking at the 2020 elections with freelance journalist Scott Nunn, HQR's Ben Schachtman. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. So let's talk some more about the purplepluity of purpleness, perplexed, per, I don't know. We need to come up with a word for the purpleness of New Hanover County. Ben Schachtman, Biden, Cooper, and Stein won. Cunningham did come close in New Hanover County. I think a difference of 158. No, Cunningham actually is 158 votes ahead. Is that right in New Hanover County?
Yes, that is correct.
But we're also looking at Mark Robinson, Michael Lee, Bill Rivenbark, Deb Hayes, Stephanie Crable. How would you explain the pattern there?
I think we're looking at two main things for me, and this is from people I've spoken with. One is, and I know we keep coming back to this, but it seems to be a resounding, like a big part of this issue, is the unaffiliated vote. And speaking to, you know, county GOP and county Democratic Party leaders, they reiterated the same thing. There's the unaffiliated vote, and then there's how much you can activate your base. We heard from almost no one who crossed party lines. It's not unheard of. You know, I could use the occasional anecdote I saw here and there on Facebook, but it feels like, by and large, these difficult to explain mixed, what looks like a mixed ticket, right? If you're looking from the president all the way down to local county races, that's largely motivated by how you could shift the unaffiliated block. And the president and Cooper is the most drastic example. And I think that if you had people whose state level concerns were really how the economy was holding up, how COVID-19 was being handled, that might be a big part of that disparity. But that's my sense of it.
So looking at the New Hanover County Board of Commissioners, how does that Republican Democratic orientation play out then? Scott, you wrote about the Democratic majority on the board courtesy of the 2018 election and noted that two of the three Democratic candidates finished at the bottom of the race this year. The only incumbent, Jonathan Barfield, squeaked into third. That could still change. How does the D or the R label play out locally on that board?
Gosh, I mean, I think it goes back to what the first person you quoted or we heard from your group from last year, is that it becomes a lot about pragmatism. I think that, for example, some of the voters saw Trump as, you know, not a very pragmatic person. I think they saw Roy Cooper, the way he's handled the COVID situation, I think has been from a pragmatic point of view. And then going down to the county commissioners, I think they reverted back to what I think is very typical of New Hanover County, is a more pragmatic, somewhat moderate type of conservative. I don't think that either Bill Rivenbark or Deb Hayes would be considered a hard right meaning Republican. It's not that you would have that often in local races, but we have in the past. And when I talked to Mayor Saffo after the election, he was saying, he would like to have seen and expected to see the Democrats do better. But, you know, he said that as far as being an official with the city, as to work close with the county, that he knows that he will be able to work well with Bill Rivenbark and Deb Hayes. So it doesn't surprise me. And I think it's actually fairly healthy to me to see that people are able to really vote for the candidate in this case and not just the party.
Ben Schachtman, you've talked before about the D and the R affiliation at the county level. It is a partisan race. So what does it mean through your eyes when somebody chooses a Republican or a Democrat? Is it really more about the person?
So sometimes, yeah. I think also a lot of the county commissioners have in the past, on both sides of the spectrum, Jonathan Barfield, Woody White, Julia Osen-Bozeman have all reiterated this idea that 99.9% of, and that's a made-up number, but, you know, a large portion of what the county commissioners do is nonpartisan. It's making sure the gears of the county run smoothly, and obviously where those are exceptions, the hospital vote, wave, issues like Project Race that sometimes split on somewhat partisan lines, that's where you saw it. But I think at election time, especially since, and we can get into this later, especially since the hospital issue seemed somewhat resolved, I think people did revert to kind of just thinking about it in practical terms. I think name recognition drives a lot of it. And I think, you know, especially in sort of the middle class, you know, and unaffiliated voters, people are looking for, you know, stability. They want the county to run well. And it didn't seem like some of the up-ticket contentiousness really made it down to the county level, although that's not that's not exclusively true. By and large, when we look at county board of commissioners race, they tend to be a little bit friendlier. And of course, there's Board of Education, which is partisan in New Hanover County, but that's not the norm. The majority of those races statewide are nonpartisan, and the North Carolina Association of Educators actually endorsed two Democrats and a Republican. That's usually a kind of a left-leaning group. So you're more likely to see it mixed up at that level.
Scott, you also spoke with Wilmington Mayor Bill Saffo about the outcome of the New Hanover County Board of Commissioners. What did he say to you about it?
Well, he, you know, like I said, the city council is you know, technically not nonpartisan, but Mayor Saffo is a Democrat and supports the Democratic Party, although he doesn't run as a Democrat. But he, once again, thought that the Democrats would do better, especially around because of all the uproar over the hospital issue. And although it appeared, you know, to be fairly well settled by then, he still thought, as I think some other people did, that the strong Republican support on the commissioners of the hospital deal by Woody White and Patricia Cusick, the two Republicans who chose not to run, that that would garner some, you know, some negativity for the Republicans, the two new Republicans who were trying to win seats, or three Republicans trying to win seats. It obviously didn't. If it would be fascinating if the hospital issue had not been settled, and we would have come to this deal where the commissioners could have well have been a vote, a sort of a referendum, essentially, on the hospital deal. But there was no guarantee either going into it a couple months ago from Leslie Cohen or Kyle Horton that they were absolutely would vote against the hospital deal. Because it became, I think, by having the Mayor Saffo thought by having the partnership advisory group take on some of the work, that was a good political move too, because it took some of the heat off of the politicians. But I was surprised to see Leslie Cohen and Kyle Horton finish that low down, although it is a big field and three seats. But they were both got exposure last time around with their other runs that they were making. So that's kind of got to be disappointing for the local Democrats, since they're two, perhaps, I wouldn't say rising stars, but they were certainly, the Democrats have had trouble in the past of even getting people to run for office. And we've had two, Leslie Cohen and Kyle Horton, run, you know, in different races over two elections and not do so well. So that's got to be a little disappointing for the Democrats.
And you raise a really interesting point. Kyle Horton ran for U.S. House in 2018, challenging Republican incumbent David Rauser. She lost, of course, but she cut the margin of the Democratic challenger losses from in the 20s in past races to into the teens. She also won New Hanover County. And Leslie Cohen, who ran for State House 2 years ago, challenged Holly Grange, incumbent, and had a fairly respectable showing, losing by about 5 points. So, Ben Shockman, why do you think both of those folks who had pretty decent name recognition finished at the bottom of the commissioner's race?
It's a good question. This is speculation on my part, so take this with the appropriate dose of salt. But I think there was quite a bit of money that came into New Hanover County from outside interests, both from a conservative lobbyist group that was supporting Reifenbach, Hayes, and Barfield, which is actually a mixed ticket, as conservative leadership you can trust. And we also saw the NC Realtors PAC put quite a bit of money towards Deb Hayes and Barfield. Now, of course, those candidates did not directly receive that money, and there's nothing they could have done about that. But definitely the outside money helped generate a lot of advertising. And I think Scott's right. I think in an alternative universe, which we in the news media had all sort of, you know, played war games with last year when they announced the hospital sale process, had the hospital still been on the table, I do think those numbers would have been different. Also, if you look at the sort of shifting attitudes of people who were criticizing the sale, it moved from this has to be stopped to kind of this place where, you know, a deal with Novant might actually be really good for the community, but we're still not happy about the transparency. So the issue became more the genesis of or the origin of the sale and how it was handled, not necessarily the sale itself was bad. So having co-signed the sale stopped being so much of a political liability.
And Kyle Horton made a big deal out of that lack of transparency. She used that. I saw it out on campaign signs, stop the secrecy. So that was, I think she realized it wasn't just the hospital deal itself. It was the process.
And just on the hospital deal itself, is there any chance that that further investigation could unravel elements of this, Ben Shachman? The attorney general was looking at the deal, was he not?
Yes, although the attorney general's office has not clarified whether they are looking into criminal or quasi-criminal allegations made by Representative Harper Peterson, or whether this is part of the statutorily required review of the sale. It's all folded into one. So it's entirely possible that Stein will say, you know, I want to tweak this aspect and this factor of the sale to bring it in line with state law, but that we won't see any criminal charges. At this point, my guess is the sale will go through pretty much uninterrupted.
You're listening to Coastline. It's a look at 2020 election results in North Carolina and the Cape Fear region and what they tell us about us. When we come back from this short break, more with Scott Nunn and Ben Shachman. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. As President Donald Trump makes his first appearance on Veterans Day, more than a week after the general election, we're taking a look at what we know, the dynamics that make this election so unorthodox, and what the implications are for southeastern North Carolina. Here to unpack some of these dynamics are Scott Nunn, freelance journalist and contributor to the Greater Wilmington Business Journal, and Ben Shachman, managing editor at WHQR. Now that Bill Rivenbark has won a seat on the new Hanover County Board of Commissioners, his half-completed term on the school board needs to be filled. Will Connect, chair of New Hanover County's GOP, tells Coastline producer Rachel Keith that the party's Leadership Development Committee interviews candidates, then they recommend a person they like to the executive committee of the party. They hope to name that person by November 16th. Ben Shachman, what would you say Rivenbark's role on the school board has been over the past couple of years, and what kind of person will they be looking for to put in his old seat?
So Mr. Rivenbark has declined several offers to be interviewed and to submit answers to campaign questions. So I'm going secondhand, but I it's my impression that he pictures himself the sort of center of homespun common sense. Which in some cases makes him seem like the resident contrarian. But I've watched several meetings where Bill has told people to move along and not worry about things and quit bickering over the fine points. He's certainly had some missteps that have drawn some criticism in the press. But he has also been outspoken about his support for, you know, the new administration, for top staff. He routinely thanks people during meetings for their efforts. So he's also largely stayed out of some of the nastier fray during what I think we can comfortably call some unhinged school board meetings.
I like that word. And the redistricting process is underway. How is this next slate of school board members likely to influence where we are in that process?
So I think we've heard from Stephanie Walker, who is the top vote-getter Democratic candidate, that they would probably leave the redistricting process alone for a year. She's been vocal that she wants to revisit it, but the process is time consuming, it's arduous, it's expensive. So I think it'll definitely be on the agenda in 2022 for sure. And I think, you know, Stephanie Crabill and Hugh McManus would probably also be on board with that.
Right. Now, I want to circle back for a second to some of the state level races that had some interesting outcomes. Marsha Morgan is another candidate, a Democratic candidate who had a pretty good showing when she ran for state house in 2018 against incumbent Ted Davis. She lost by less than 2.5 points. But then in 2020, when she ran against Republican Charlie Miller, no incumbent in the state house District 19 because of legislative redistricting, Ted Davis moved over to District 20. She lost overall in that district by 16 points. And that district includes New Hanover and Brunswick counties. But in New Hanover, where you might expect a better showing, she lost as well by more than 5 points. Scott Nunn, was that a surprise to you?
Yeah, once again, just like with Leslie Cohen and with Dr. Kyle Horton, I expected perhaps a better showing simply because of, you know, they had run at higher level, fairly higher level races, and Marshall Morgan's name had become well known, but there was something missing there. And I'm looking at the numbers right now. Yeah, Charlie Miller in New Hanover County, 52.6%. Marshall Morgan, 42.3%. So a pretty established win there. So I thought she would have fared a little better. Even in the past, those candidates who have been in cross county races, they have done better, tended to do better, the Democrats in the New Hanover County piece of it. For example, I think it was interesting this time that although David Rouser, the incumbent representative in the 7th district, although he won New Hanover County, Chris Ward had a fairly decent showing at 48. That was 51.5% to 48.2% for David Rouser. So Christopher Ward did well, a total newcomer. And then these three women Democrats who had some fairly good name recognition didn't do well. So that's interesting to me. Let me know a little more. I'll be interested to know what the campaign, the Democratic leadership thinks about that. And do these three candidates have a future, and or are we going to see them again next time around?
And it's interesting you talk about female Democratic candidates. Deb Butler is now the lone Democratic state representative in the Cape Fear region. She's the Democratic incumbent in House District 18, walloped her Republican challenger Warren Kennedy by almost 20 points. Ben Shockman, what does that tell you? How did Deb Butler pull that off?
You would expect someone who has been accused of such vileness as being a socialist to not do as well in a region that, you know, trends sort of right down the middle. But she routinely, comes ahead by 10 plus points. And I think, you know, she's been outspoken. She's been in the press. She has a lot of name recognition. And when I've seen her, she's very good at doing something that is hard for state level representatives, which is to explain how what happens in Raleigh matters to someone here. At the county commissioner level, you can always go to taxes. You can always go to development projects that people are, you know, that's going to impact your life this week. It's a little harder figuring out how one person in Raleigh out of, you know, the entire General Assembly is going to, you know, make your life better. But she's been good at driving home points on the environment, on film, on infrastructure. So, you know, I credit her messaging.
I'm really intrigued to see where she goes. She's an upstart politician, no doubt, y'all remember what she did on the House floor when they were trying to perhaps sneak in some votes, and she got into the national media. So she's a good effective politician. So I've got the feeling that we may see more from Representative Butler than just this serving in this House seat.
Well, now that Scott Nunn, you've brought up that moment, that I will not yield moment. Tell us that story for those who don't know the story.
Let's see. Help me here, Ben. This was where they voted on. Was this the budget? The budget vote.
I can't remember if it was the budget or if it was the legislative maps. Actually.
Yeah. Okay. And they were trying to.
No, you're right. It was the state budget session.
they were trying to perhaps vote when people were out at, they knew they were going to be out at other meetings. And so lots of the weird ones on in Raleigh, but Representative Butler, you know, took to the floor and made sort of this fiery speech. And I think she ended up being on some national media, and she, whether you agree with her or not, she won some points and handled herself quite well. So she seemed, Representative Butler to me seems to have that type of presence that's going to carry her, you know, further up the political ladder. I don't know what would be, you know, whether it's a Senate seat, you know, Lieutenant Governor, perhaps, but it, who knows, Attorney General. It will be interesting to see where, you know, where her political career takes her. I think she's proven herself to be very effective.
Now, some Democrats would argue that the maps that constituents voted on in this election only, there will be new maps because of the new census data for 2021. They would argue these were gerrymandered. There were other maps thrown out. This has been a long process moving through the court system. Is this something that, Ben Schachtman, you think people are going to move forward on in terms of finding a way to do this independently? Because we heard politicians on both sides, Republicans and Democrats, express support for an independent redistricting process.
So I think there will always be the political will in some parts of the party to continue the fight because it's been successful. And North Carolina is by no means the only state where this happens. But there is, you know, the more I talk to people, there's a growing level of exhaustion because there are gerrymandering is, you know, the term when you go too far in one direction or the other. But you have to actually make these kind of odd maps so that they have hit certain representative benchmarks. And at a certain point, just handing it over to someone else and saying, let's see where the chips fall. And, you know, maybe we turn to messaging, or maybe we turn to, you know, voter engagement instead of trying to do this at the map level. If it doesn't happen this year, I can see it happening within 4 years where they just turn to an independent group and say, just give us a map that we don't have to go to court over.
We've talked about Senate District 9, which was a rematch of 2018. Ultimately, you know, this was a pretty close race. Former Senator Michael Lee succeeded somewhat narrowly in unseating current Senator Harper Peterson. What dynamics, Scott Nunn, do you think were in play this year that allowed Michael Lee to reclaim that seat?
Well, one thing that struck me is the that the Gen X issue was not as prevalent this year. It was still out there, there's no doubt, and perhaps even the bigger issue beyond Gen X is some of the other water pollutants that are still on the table. That argument or that issue was probably put to the side a little bit by the by the pandemic. It was my impression that Harper Peterson won office last time around, perhaps on that Gen X issue, which Michael Lee took a lot of heat over. So with that off the table, once again, Lee is, I think, comes off as a bit of a middle of the road, not an arch conservative. He may be, but he doesn't appear to come off that way. But I think just like we New Hanover perhaps reset itself to its a little bit of Republican trend, the same thing happened with Lee. I think Harper Peterson winning that seat was a little bit of an anomaly to begin with and surprised me.
Now, I want to circle back to what the new Hanover County commissioners might be doing with this new slate of commissioners in 2021. Affordable housing is something that both R's and D's discussed, Ben Schachtman. Deb Hayes has talked a lot about affordable housing, as has Jonathan Barfield. Do you think that they will move the needle on this issue?
So I'm hearing, to be completely candid, it took a long time for affordable housing to get traction in New Hanover County and the city of Wilmington. There was an ad hoc committee to address it that took years to get together and ultimately create a standing committee. But there is some sense that now the ball is rolling. I've spoken to some of the commissioners, both commissioners-elect and current commissioners, and there's a sense that now there is kind of the political will to go and do this. It's going to involve a couple different approaches. Some will make people happy, some won't make people happy. Negotiating with developers who want to rezone and use special use permits and sort of saying like, okay, you can turn this agricultural land into apartments, but you got to have 10% affordable housing, that kind of thing. And another way of approaching it will be the job market. It's kind of an angle people don't often think of when it comes to affordable housing. If you're increasing the median pay, people have more money, they can afford more, they're less housing burdened. So even though that seems like sort of a tangential issue, it's part of how the commissioners are starting to see this. And there's also some early talk of maybe, you know, discussing this at a multi-county level. You know, Wilmington is the metropolis, and it creates ripples of housing costs throughout Pender County in the Hampstead area, and obviously Brunswick County in the Leland area. So it might be time that we see commissioners from Pender, Brunswick, and New Hanover County sitting down and having sort of an earnest conversation about that. But I'm actually quite optimistic that we'll see that on the agenda in the coming year.
Let's talk about the racial equity conversation. If the final outcome of the New Hanover County Board of Commissioners pushes Jonathan Barfield out of the mix, then we have an all-white board again. And Ben Schachtman, do you think that all-white board is going to effectively move that conversation forward?
I got to be totally honest. I don't think anyone on the board or anyone who could be on the board is a racist or a bigot. But I don't see that conversation evolving without some representation. I think, you know, to a certain extent, what we've seen so far, you know, renaming a park or the position that Linda Thompson now has as the sort of equity czar, I don't think that's really connected 100% with what we're hearing from, you know, Black communities. So I would like to see that conversation moving forward, but, you know, without representation, I don't see that. I don't know who takes up that mantle and really pushes it forward.
Scott Nunn, if we're so divided now that we're having a hard time talking about just even the election results, do you think we're headed into a year of greater division, or do you think there will be more interest in cooperation and collaboration across party lines?
My suspicion and my hope, too, is that one positive thing out of the COVID situation will require us to be more, a little more cooperative, and perhaps people are just we're all kind of worn down a little bit. And the last thing we need, if we can get this presidential issue settled, is let's get a little bit more back to normal. I don't think anyone wants a COVID fight and a bunch of other fights going on at the same time. And I think that as a parent, especially of two kids who are in New Hanover County school system, I think the Board of Education is going to have their hands full trying to come up with some solutions if we continue having to have kids going to school only 2 days a week, and many kids not going at all, just doing the virtual piece. So I'm hoping, that that's not a great way to get unity, but perhaps it will help.
Ben Schachtman.
Oh, boy. I do think, the hope from people I've heard is that this election will be, it's not a repudiation of Trump, because 71 million people still voted for him, right? But I think that the underlying idea is that, like Scott's saying, there may be a level of exhaustion that now brings people to a point where they might walk away from far left and far right politics. But I got to say, we're seeing it in the opinion page of the Wall Street Journal. We're seeing it on Facebook, that there are still strong voices on both sides that are basically saying that working with the other side is tantamount to crime. You know, we've seen people saying that reaching across the aisle for Democrats is a support of white supremacy. And that's strong language. I hope that's just on the fringe, but I don't know if we're in the era of good feelings yet.
And that is this edition of Coastline. Scott Nunn, Ben Schachtman, thank you both so much for being with us today.
Thank you. It's been fun. Very educational.
Coastline's producer is Rachel Keith. Technical director is Ken Campbell. Andrew Craig engineered this episode. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org. Get the podcast, find it on the HQR app, or just listen for the rebroadcast Sunday afternoon at 2. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.